Okay, I'm at Marilyn White's house, Amy Kitchener, on July 24th, 1992. And I want just to start off by asking you, when and where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles, California, October 17th, 1944, at 1:25 a.m., Hoover Street Hospital.
Who were your parents?
My mother is Mary Lorenza Susan Johnson White. My father, L.A. Nelson White.
And what did they do?
My father was a custodian for L.A. Unified School District for as many years as I can remember, and my mother worked for the United States Post Office.
What did she do there?
She was a letter sorter.
Uh-huh.
A clerk.
And when did she finish working there?
Oh, my. Let me think. Probably in the late 60s. When she retired.
Uh-huh. Do you know where did she work at which
station? She worked at Terminal Annex downtown, and then when Worldway Post Office was built, she transferred to Worldway Post Office, and that's where she retired from.
And what about your grandparents? Who were they?
On my mother's side, her father was Julius Caesar Johnson, and her mother was Coralie Agathe Jacques.
And
on my father's side, his mother was Ella Sarah Thompson White, and his father was George O. Paris White.
And could you tell me a little bit about them and where they lived and what they did?
My grandparents, you
mean? Yes, please.
Well, my grandparents lived in Lawrence, Kansas until approximately 1900. After my father was born, they moved, well, I have to back up a little bit because they were in Lawrence, Kansas. My Aunt Gladys was born in 1900, and they moved to Denver, Colorado from Lawrence, Kansas. And then from Lawrence, Kansas and Denver, they moved to Arizona. From Arizona, they moved to California.
Do you know why they moved from Kansas?
Well, my grandmother had found her real mother. She was adopted early on by Nelson and Sarah Thompson of Lawrence, Kansas, but her real mother was Molly Varnes. This was something that she wrote in her autobiography, that she had finally found her real mother, and her real mother lived in Arizona. So they left Denver to go to Arizona. And they were in Denver because my grandmother had lost a baby. It had died. And when my father was conceived, they were afraid that she was going to lose that baby also. So she moved back from Denver, where my grandfather was working on a railroad. She moved back to Lawrence, Kansas to be with her family when my father was born. Otherwise, he would have been born in Denver.
And then they moved to Arizona?
They moved to Arizona. Oh, probably 1903 or so, and they stayed in Arizona until 1911. I knew that I was going to have my gardener come here.
That's okay.
Just at this time, I hope it blocks out.
Okay.
So they moved to Arizona around 1911 or so, and then to Los Angeles by 1917.
And why did they come to Los Angeles?
Well, I'm not sure exactly why they came to Los Angeles. I think it was because they already had someone living here in the Los Angeles area. Actually, it wasn't Los Angeles, it was Yuba City. And that was, what was his name? Not Clarence. Oh, it'll come to me in a few minutes.
Okay.
Anyhow, they had somebody who was already living in Yuba City. And I think it was mainly because of the racial problems that were happening around Phoenix at the time.
Did your grandmother tell you about those problems?
Well, in her autobiography, she talks about certain movies that were being shown in Arizona, and their black women's club there was picketing so that those movies wouldn't be shown. It degraded blacks. And for the life of me, I cannot remember the name of the movie, but it was one of those that depicted blacks in a very poor manner. And they were successful in getting the movie theater to not show the picture, but that was the only thing that she, you know, told me about. My father has a picture of, I guess it was about 1920 or so, of a lynching, and that was really sad to see. But that was in Tyler, Texas, and there was just so much racial strife going on. I think that's why they came here. There was more of a chance of succeeding here.
Do you know how your father came to have those photographs?
No, I don't. They were in his belongings that we looked at after he died, and I don't know how he got them. But I do remember my cousin Yeto saying that my grandfather had just barely escaped being lynched, and I don't know if that was the same lynching or not.
But did your father ever show them to you while he was alive?
Never.
No.
Never. It was quite a shock to see them.
They are shocking. Mm-hmm. And what about your grandparents on the other side?
Well, Julius Caesar Johnson worked for the railroad, and he stayed in Kansas City, Missouri, while my mother came out here to live with relatives. And she came here mainly to work and to go to school. After she found out that it was a pretty good place to live, then the rest of the family came out from Kansas City, Missouri, and lived here.
Okay. Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have one brother, Robert Milton White, who is currently living in Brazil. He's been in Brazil for, probably 16 years now. He's married a Brazilian woman there and seems to be quite happy. He's a translator and an engineer. He went through schooling again. He graduated from Redlands here in California, but when he got to Brazil, he found out that the credentials that he had from here really were not going to take him anywhere, so he ended up going back to school again for the same major in Brazil. But he, you know, did get that. And then I have two sisters, both of whom are in Georgia right now. One lives in Jonesboro, Georgia. That's Donna Camilla White. And her sister, her twin, Donna's Camille White, lives in Decatur, Georgia. Donna's was there first, and Donna was absolutely miserable without her twin, so she convinced her husband to transfer on his job. And he was working for IBM at the time, and so he was lucky enough to be able to transfer and go to Georgia, and that's where they live now.
And
the twins are together again.
And where are you in the family? Which child?
I'm the oldest child. Uh-huh. I always say that I had 4 years to get my parents organized and ready for the rest of the family.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up right here in Los Angeles, California. I'm native born. I didn't leave Los Angeles until my first year of teaching, which was in 1967. And I taught for 1 year, almost exactly to the day, in Washington, D.C. And then I came back home and started working for LA Unified.
And where was the family home where you grew up?
Let's see. Well, the first family home was 1158 and a half East 41st Place. We lived behind my grandmother. In fact, my grandparents, because when I was first born, my grandfather was alive. He died. I don't even remember exactly when he died. But we lived behind them. And then when I was, I would say about 8 years old, we moved to 231 West 43rd Street. And that was right off of Broadway and 43rd. And I went to Holy Cross School, which was on 47th and Broadway. And I can remember walking back and forth to school from there. Then we lived at 1825 Wilton Place, which is right off of Washington, and I went to Conaty High School, and I was able to walk from there. And the last place that we moved before I moved independently was at 2319 West 109th in Inglewood.
I see. Why? It seems like you moved a lot of times. Was there any certain reason for that your family moved?
Well, mainly because we were each time making a step up. You know, first we were behind my grandmother's house. It was a tiny little bungalow. And then my brother and I were born at that time. And then the twins were on their way, and we moved to 43rd Street for more space. And then we went, oh, I forgot Brighton, 2956 Brighton. After we were on 43rd, we were in Brighton. And then from Brighton to Washington. But it really, it wasn't that many moves, actually, when you look at the span of years involved.
What do you remember about those different neighborhoods?
Well, I don't remember a lot about my grandmother's neighborhood, except that I had my very first boyfriend who lived next door. And I had ballet lessons. I remember that. And I used to always follow my dad down to Central. He would walk down to Central to go to the market. And I loved hot dogs. So my dad would go to the market, and he would always get me a hot dog. But the neighbor said, every time you see Nelson White, you're going to see Marilyn, because she's his shadow. And that's quite true. It's always been true. You want to pause for one moment?
Yes.
I'm going
to
go and close this. Let's see. I would always follow my dad down to the market, so I was basically his shadow. And then when we moved to 43rd Street, I can remember being kind of the lady of the house, because my mother worked at night and my father worked during the day, and I'd have to always get up early in the morning and make my father's breakfast and his lunch. And I hated getting up so early to do that. But I did it because that's what I had to do. But I can remember one day actually rebelling against this, and I made my father a watermelon sandwich. And when he got home from work, there was nothing that I could do except just stand there and know I was going to get spanked, because I'd really done it this time. But I can remember that happening. That was on 43rd
Street. How old were you?
Oh, I guess I was around 9 or 10. I can remember having my 10th birthday there, and my making a birthday cake. The recipe called for melting the butter, and everybody was gone. Mom was gone somewhere. My dad had gone somewhere, so I was there by myself, and I melted the butter in the broiler, and I caught the kitchen on fire. And instead of having sense enough to call somebody, I ran next door to the neighbor. And Mrs. Franklin said, well, what's the matter? And I just kind of stood there and looked at it for a while. And then finally I said, the kitchen's on fire. And she called the fire department, and that was all taken care of. But that birthday, besides the cake and burning half of the kitchen down, I can remember getting my first record player. And I still have that record player. So I've had it all this time.
Wow.
Yeah. When we were on Brighton, this was during the time that I was preparing to go to the Olympic Games, and I was practicing all the time. I was doing the long jump and the sprints. And the sprints I couldn't practice in our backyard, but the long jump I could. And my father dug out a long jump pit in our backyard and filled it with sand. And I remember that. And sometimes when I pass that neighborhood now, I glance down there to see if my long jump pit's still there. Let's see. After that, we went to Wilton Place. And the only thing I really remember about Wilton Place was living across the street from one of the girls in my school, Marcia Hickman. And I don't know why. I remember her so well, but I can't tell you exactly why. Somehow or another, she really impressed upon me something, but I don't even remember what it is. I just know that I remember her from there. On 109th Street,
in
Englewood,
I was kind
of grown up, and I can remember.
What years were those?
Oh my goodness, let me see. Well, it had to be maybe 67. Because I was going to Pepperdine. I had finished Pepperdine College. I had gotten a scholarship. I started out at UCLA, and then I got a track and field scholarship to go to Pepperdine. So I finished at Pepperdine and graduated in 67. And the month after I graduated, I decided I was going to Washington, D.C., because there was a good coach there, and I was thinking, well, maybe I'll try for the 68 games. And, you know, so I got to Washington, D.C., and I got a job. And my very first time really away from home, I can remember being the PE teacher at Adams Mill elementary school, and my PE office was in the basement. And they had this federal lunch program, and they couldn't throw anything away. They had to burn it. They you know, because they were afraid if they threw it away, somebody would get it, and I don't know. They just didn't want it to be useful, I guess. And I can remember in the winter time being down there in that basement with all the burning oranges and stuff and still trying to do PE with the kids. The very first winter I was there, I was doing snowball throw for accuracy and all kinds of things in the snow because I hadn't seen snow before. So I had all these kids outside and we're all throwing snowballs and rolling in the snow and making angels in the snow. None of the kids got sick, but I did. So that the reason I brought that up is because I can remember that Christmas being so homesick and coming back home on 109th and feeling so good that I was back home. So that's kind of it.
And I was going to ask you about your education, where you went to school. You touched on that a little bit. What do you remember about school and experiences and learning and what your interests were?
Well, I loved going to school. I just didn't like studying. And I guess that's kind of typical of all kids, actually. I was basically a brat. Always into something. Always had something to say. I was very stubborn. And I can remember in the third grade, my mom... Somebody in my mother's family had died, and so we went to the rosary the night before, which was on a weekday, and I hadn't done my homework. So I went back to school the next day, and I tried to explain to the teacher that, you know, something had occurred in the family, and I didn't do my homework. And at that time, being in Catholic school, well, they kind of got
Were you Catholic?
On the hand. Yes, yes, I still am. This particular teacher decided that, well, you didn't do your homework, so I'm going to swat you on the hand with this little red stick. And I remember this little red stick so well. And I looked her straight in the eye and I said, as long as you keep hitting me with the stick, I'm not going to do my homework. And that went on for weeks. Every single day she would hit me on the hand because I wouldn't turn in homework. And finally she said, you're incorrigible, I give up. And as soon as she said that, I went to my... Well, we didn't have book bags in those days, but I went to my folder and pulled out all the homeworks. I had done them. I just wasn't going to give them to her. And I gave her all of the homeworks. But I was really kind of a stubborn little kid. And then I guess I was a fighter, too. It seemed like somebody was always picking on either my brother or my sisters. Or they would start it, and they'd say, Marilyn, Marilyn, they're hitting me, and I'd, of course, have to defend them because these are my baby sisters and brother, you know. And I can remember one day we were walking down Broadway, because this was when we were living on 43rd Street, and I was going to Holy Cross. So we walked down Broadway, and in those days, they put the cans out separately. They usually had a wooden box or something, and they put the tin cans in the wooden box. And this eighth grader pushed my little brother into those cans, and he cut his hand. And as soon as I saw the blood, I just went totally berserk. And being a ballet student, I was able to do high kicks, and I did, I'm telling you, all kinds of high kicks. And I got into so much trouble, but I was defending my little brother. And that's what I had to do, I felt. And then I can remember treating all of the kids at Thrifty's with the raffle money from the raffle tickets. I was a terrible, terrible brat. I really was. But I had a great childhood. I had a fun childhood. And I'm really sorry that the kids nowadays don't get to have that kind of fun. I mean, we weren't bad. We were just mischievous little kids, you know, just rascals into everything. In high school, all of a sudden, I decided, well, I guess I should study something. And I got wonderful grades in high school. I was on the volleyball team and the basketball team, and that's when I was really introduced to track and field in high school at Bishop Conaty. We had a field day once a year, and I still have my very first trophy that I got there. It was great fun. Great fun. And it turned me on to excelling in something. It felt good to excel.
In athletics?
In athletics and in studies and whatever I did. At that point, I wanted to be the best at whatever I did. Don't ask me how the transition occurred, because if I could figure out how it occurred, I would be absolutely happy to teach my kids that. But I don't know how it occurred, so I can't.
So you really became a student at that point?
I really became a student at that point. And then I went from that very small Carmody High School to UCLA, and it was just a world of difference, a world of difference. There was nobody there to tell me you have to do this and you have to do that. There were no, quote, rules. So I did what all the rest of the kids did. I went to the coop and I learned to play bidwiz, and I went to class when I felt like it. I ended up on probation, on academic probation. And it was just a struggle uphill. It was just really hard to apply myself without having somebody to compete with. And I didn't realize at the time that's what the problem was, but I think that's what the problem was.
What do you mean, somebody to compete with? Who were you competing with before, and how was it different?
Oh, with all of the people in the class. The classes were very small in high school. The school was small. So if you did something really well, everybody knew who you were. You had done something really great.
So there wasn't the feeling of individuality at UCLA?
No, I was just a number. I was just one of however many. And there didn't seem really to be anybody who cared whether I made it or not. Well, my parents, of course, did. Mm-hmm. And they were pushing from their end the best that they could push. But something about that excelling, I don't know, it just seemed like so much work to excel that I didn't really excel. Except in one area, and that was track and field. And that one area helped me, I guess, be known at UCLA, because I was freshman vice president. I ran for and was elected to the freshman vice presidency at UCLA. I wasn't all that good a vice president, because it was hard to be a part of that campus, and being a commuting student was very difficult to do. And I'd have to leave at a certain time, or I'd miss my bus, and I'd miss a lot of meetings. And it was very frustrating, very frustrating. So I never ran for any other office, again, because I wanted to give it everything I had, and I wasn't able to. But I did qualify for and go to the Olympic Games in 1964 while I was a student at UCLA. I wasn't on their track team. I was on the Los Angeles Mercurettes. I was the very first member. And there's a whole story that goes with that, too.
I want to hear that, too.
Okay. Well, I was taking, as I said, I was a ballet student. I took ballet, I took tap, I took acrobatics, I took modern dance.
This is in high school?
This is, forever, since I can remember. I can remember taking tap dance and all that. My mom and dad made sure that we had other activities to do. So as young as 5 or 6 years old, I was dancing or, acrobatics or something. And I was at a dance class on Washington and Arlington, and this guy came in who was a friend of the teacher and asked, "Who's that girl with the big legs?" And of course, it was me. So the teacher told him who I was, and he says, "I bet she can run." And so he took me out on the track, not that same day, of course, but he took me out on the track, and I barely made it around one time. I mean, I struggled. But I was determined I was not going to lose face in front of this strange man. So I struggled until I got all the way around. He says, "Well, you're not very fast, but you're pretty determined. So I'm going to train you." And he started working with me. And this was, I was still in high school. I was a senior in high school. And he took me to the indoor track and field meet at the sports arena to see Wilma Rudolph run. And oh, I was just so enamored with this. And I thought, well, I'm going to beat that lady next year. And you know what? I did. He got me in shape. I qualified for that meet. And in the first heat, I couldn't understand why or how the press was asking me all these questions. I couldn't figure out, well, what are they doing? Why are they doing that? And it was because I had beat the German champion in the preliminaries, And I didn't realize I had done that because I came to be Wilma Rudolph. That's who I wanted. And it was really a phenomenal evening, and I got Athlete of the Meet Award, and I still have that trophy in there, too. It was phenomenal. But that was the one thing that I really excelled in. And so that next year, in 63, it wasn't even the next year, it was part of the same year. In 63, I qualified for the Pan American Games in Brazil, and I went there, and I came out, I think it was third or fourth in the 100 meters, and we ran the relay, and it was okay, it wasn't the greatest. I was so homesick, and I was still sending lessons home. Everybody else was having a great time, and I was doing German homework, trying to send it back to UCLA, and as it turned out, I failed German anyway. But
can you tell me, who was this guy who trained you?
Was Fred Jones.
And did he go around to all the schools looking for young talent to train?
No,
or
he happened to be there at this dance class, and he had gone to Morgan State. He was a track man himself at Morgan State, and he wanted to coach. This was his opportunity to coach. It was his first track team and my first track team.
And his track team was called?
Well, we named it the L.A. Mercurettes. Mm-hmm. And I was the very first member of that track team. And since then, there have been lots of folks that have made Olympic Games, Barbara Farrell being one of them. She ran in two Olympic Games. So he's a good coach.
And he's still around? And
oh, yes. In
doing
fact,
that
at my son's graduation from high school, I looked up, and who should be there but Fred Jones himself. He said two of his athletes, whom he was taking to the Olympic trials that next week in New Orleans, were graduating in the same class as my son. So, yes, he's still coaching.
And can you tell me, okay, so there was 63, and then you did the L.A. Invitational.
Invitational was January 19th, 1962. The Pan American Games were in April of 63. Olympic Games were in October of 64.
Can you tell me about your experience at the Olympics?
It was a phenomenal experience. I think that was the last of the non-political Olympic Games in 64. Because as you know, in 68, there was just turmoil. It was wonderful. I had gotten over the shock of being away from home for any length of time. But I still ran up phone bills, of course. And I saved letters that my mother wrote me in Olympic Village, so I still got those letters, you know, here. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. I was frustrated because I ran fourth in the 100 meters with the same time as second and third place, but I got fourth. And I think it was because I'm shorter, and even a lean doesn't appear to actually cover the distance that a lean of a taller person would cover. And then there was the relay. The relay pass got messed up between my leg and Wyoming Atias's anchor leg. And I believe it to be because Coach Ed Temple changed the steps, our lead-in steps for the pass after the preliminaries. We ran beautifully in the prelims, and he says, oh, no, we can stretch it out more. And he had Wyoming Tyus take off earlier, and it was hard to catch her. So we bobbled our pass, and we came in second instead of first. So it was a frustrating games, but it was a learning experience. It was a wonderful experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world, because once you are an Olympian, you are an Olympian forever, and nobody can ever take that away from you. And then having a silver medal on top of it all is great. For a long time, I was aggravated. I didn't even want to look at the silver medal because I thought it should have been a gold. But it has come to represent my place standing in the 100 meters in my mind, because if I tied with the same time as second and third, I should have had one of those medals. They should have duplicated the medals.
In the 100 meters, you run individually rather than as
yes.
a relay.
Yes.
Uh-huh. What was your specialty then in track?
I loved the 100 meters. I loved indoors. Indoors was just such a nice feeling running on the track, mainly because I'm short and I have a short, choppy stride. So I ran indoors on the wood. You can feel it more, and it bounces you up. It's a nice feeling. So I like indoors. Outdoors, I like the 100 meters, but I seem to have been better in the 200 meters a lot of the time. But I didn't particularly like it. It was having to run too fast, too long.
You were really a sprinter then.
I'm a sprinter. Mm-hmm. I say I am a sprinter because I think once you are, you just are. Last year, our school where I work had a faculty-student baseball game, and when it was my turn up at bat, I hit the ball and ran to first base, and I couldn't believe how fast I got to first base. And afterwards, everybody said, "Wow, you really can still move it." And here I am, 100 pounds, and I can still run. But you don't lose it. And I did run again in 1984. I lost a lot of weight because I couldn't stand to have my Olympic friends come to Los Angeles and see me fat.
That was the year.
I lost a lot of weight that year, and I decided to participate in Masters Track and Field.
Which is?
That's for age group track and field. So you run against people of your own age. And
at the Olympics?
No. Uh-huh. This is just the Amateur Athletic Union.
Okay.
But it's age group wise. So if you're 60 years old, you run with the 60-year-olds, and there's no threat, no problems, And I really did well. I did very well. I ran the 100, the 200, and one 400. I really am not all that thrilled with the 400. I used to double 100, 400 when I was actually running track. And it's a very hard double because the moment you finish the 100, usually the 400 has been scheduled because they don't expect anybody to run that combination, but I did. But I ended up representing the Los Angeles Striders track team in Eugene, Oregon. I came out second in the 100 meters, first in the shot put, and second in the discus. I couldn't believe it. But I got back in shape. I lost 40 pounds. And it was not dieting or anything. It was just going out there and being active. And I keep saying, well, maybe I'll go out and be active again, because you do not lose it. It's still there.
Sounds good. What was, if you had to pinpoint one experience in your sports career that was sort of the highlight or the most exciting or most meaningful one, could you pick one?
Oh, my goodness. Actually, I can't. It was Olympic trials. And they were in 1964. They were held in New York. And I had heard about these wonderful Olympic Games and had only dreamt of being in the competition, to come up high enough in the competition to even qualify. And I remember the night that I qualified for the 100 meters, calling home and having my whole family laughing and crying and yelling in the phone on one end, and me laughing and crying and yelling in the phone on the other end. That was great. That was really good. And I was just grateful that I was able to go to the Olympic Games while my father was still alive to see it, because, his baby. And with him going through what he did, because that man worked so hard as a custodian. And then in the evenings, he would take me to practice. And sometimes, he would be asleep at practice because it was just so hard on him. And he did that every single day. And when I had double practices, he made sure I got to both of them. When we had track meets, he drove all over creation on the weekend, on his days off, just so that I could participate. And I was just so glad that I made it while he could see it.
What were their aspirations for you?
I don't ever remember my mother or father telling me what I should be in life. I can remember my father saying that as a black person, you're going to have to work twice as hard to go half as far. And I always remember that. And I remember my mom telling me, whatever you've decided you want to be, you can be that. Don't worry about it. Just go do it. So they never really told me what to be.
But it sounds like they were very supportive of
you. Oh, absolutely. I can remember some of the sacrifices that they made, because during the time I was running track, all of the nutritionists were saying, well, you know, protein, protein, protein. Of course, that meant steaks and hamburger. And looking back on it now, I can think of times when my whole family, my two sisters and my brother and my mom and dad, were eating beans, and I was sitting there eating a steak. And nobody made any differentiation between what we were eating. We were just having dinner. To them, they didn't mind giving that up to make sure that I had what I needed to do what I wanted to do. And I think back on that, and it just, oh gosh, it chokes me, because to think what the whole family sacrificed so that I could do what I wanted to do. But I think we've gotten away from that, and that's what's really sad and makes me unhappy about what's happening in today's society. It's very sad that a lot of people don't feel that way anymore.
How did you decide to go into teaching?
I think I have been a teacher since I was age 2 or 3. I really believe that teachers are born, they're not made. And I can remember when we lived on 43rd Street, our backyard had this pomegranate tree. And it was a giant tree that came out and looked like a cave. There was a little dark area you could go inside. And I used to play school out there. I'd make my little sisters and my brother sit there, and I'd play school with them. And, you know, sometimes the kids in the neighborhood would come over and we'd play school. I mean, I was always the teacher, you know, the one who was going to take care of it all, even though I was the one that was probably the worst student. The one that, my third grade teacher, I know that poor lady probably pulled her hair out every single night when she went home, because she had this incorrigible student in her classroom. But that lady, Mrs. Cutler, was the one person who recognized that I had talent in teaching. And she asked me, when I was in high school, she asked me if I would help her in her tutoring service. Now, here's a kid that we had bumped horns. I thought we were mortal enemies, actually. And yet and still, she pushed me so hard because she knew what was there. And then she let it kind of simmer. And then when I was in high school, she invited me back to work with her. And that, you know, again, I just have lived such a blessed life. The Lord has just put all of these wonderful people in my path to push me the direction I need to go.
Were there others who inspired you as teachers to want to be like them? Or?
Oh, my chemistry teacher at Conaty, Sister Mary Donald. That lady was so patient and so kind. She taught chemistry and physics. She was another one who pushed me and would not let me get away with doing things halfway, because she knew that I could do them well. But she did it in such a loving way that I wanted to do everything she wanted me to do. And I ended up getting the Bausch and Lomb Science Award because of the way she had pushed and had helped me to develop. And then there was another teacher who will remain unnamed. And the Lord has never let me find her, because I want to say to her in Spanish that, yes, I will get a grasp of the language. I was told that I would never get a grasp of the Spanish language. And here I am, a bilingual teacher now.
Do you think that someone telling you that
made you stubborn? Yes. I'm sure that's it. If you tell me you can't do this or you can't do that, well, I'm going to go do this, and then I'll do that to show you that I can. That's true. Reverse psychology worked very well on me.
So could you tell me about your teaching career and what you're doing now, or maybe give me a little bit of the history of where you've taught and what you've taught and what your experience has been?
Well, I left Pepperdine College in August and went to Washington, D.C. I went to the Board of Education in Washington, D.C. and said, ta-da, here I am. I have a bachelor's in physical education with no minor, but here I am. You need me. And they actually gave me a job. I taught for 1 year in Washington, D.C. as a physical education teacher. Then I came back to Los Angeles, and I taught as a physical education teacher here. In fact, I got the job the very next year. I can honestly say I've never had to fill out a resume. I wouldn't even know how, I don't think, because I never had to do it. I got a job as a physical education teacher, and then in the talent search program, they took whichever person had a bachelor's degree and put them into a classroom. Now, I started out through talent search in LA Unified, which means that I did not start out directly into physical education. It's what I ended up doing, because when I went to 92nd Street School, which was my very first school, I was told, okay, we're going to teach you for a while, for 6 weeks. We'll show you everything you need to know. Then we're going to give you a class. Well, a week into the program, they found out that I had a bachelor's degree in physical education, and they needed a PE teacher for their, I think it was 1,100 students at the time. And they plucked me out of the classroom and said, okay, see all those kids out there? They're yours. Bye. And they just kind of left me. That's why I'm saying, you know, you're either born a teacher or you're not. And I looked at all those kids and I thought, okay, I have 5 classes here and no teachers, so I have to do something. So I made them all do calisthenics like I had seen the Chinese doing on all the newscasts, right? And that turned out to be a good program. And I'd break them into groups and we'd play basketball, we'd do, you know, whatever. And we ended up having a field day, kind of like the ones that we had at Conaty when I was there. But I invited all of the folks that I knew, and this was right after Olympic Games, so I had a lot of contacts, and we had C.K. Yang and Rayford Johnson come out, and Billy Mills. They all came to my school for this field day, and they judged the races and handed out medals, and the newspaper came, and the TV came. It was wonderful. And then I transferred to 95th Street School. Actually, I started at Hyde Park, and then I went to 92nd when I was assigned. Okay, and then I went to 95th Street School. And at 95th, I got tired of doing PE. It was just too much having to be up all of the time, all day long, for all of these kids. And I would see 1,400 kids a week. And one person, it was just too much. They got me an assistant. And that worked for a while, but we had different ideas of what should be happening, and it was just conflict. So the next year I thought, okay, I'm going in the classroom. I have a credential just like everybody else's. I should be able to do this. I had never gotten through the training, but I figured I trained all the way since I was 5. I should know how to do this. And I asked for a kindergarten because I figured, well, I at least know the material. How can you go wrong if you know the material? So I taught kindergarten actually for 7 years, and my room partner was a wonderful lady by the name of Audrey Wilson. She has since, you know, died, but that lady taught me so much, and she was so patient, and I was just hungry to learn because this was really fun. You know, this is my idea of a job. You know, you look forward to going on Monday, and you're really sorry that Friday has come, and teaching has remained that way for me, even now. During vacation time, I'm usually looking in Pick and Save or swap meets to find stuff that I can use the next year. Even though they're cutting my salary, I'm still spending, you know. But it's a matter of wanting to do the best job that you can do. And if you're not given what you need, you get whatever you need to do the job you have to do.